Now, you can't ask you and me whether our reaction to alcohol is abnormal, because our reaction is the only reaction we know. We don't know of any other. What you have to do is you have to go to the 9 out of 10 normal drinkers, and you have to ask them what happens. You have to ask them. They're normal drinkers. So we have to establish this baseline by asking them. So you ask them, you say, okay, you drink normally. What happens after you have one or two drinks and you begin to feel the effects of alcohol? And he said, oh, I get a little tipsy and nauseous, and I don't want any more, and I set it up. Or I get that warm, comfortable, relaxing, sleepy feeling, and I want to lay down and take a nap, and I said, don't drink anymore. Or they say, I feel out of control. And I don't like feeling out of control, so I don't drink anymore. You try to get them to take more, and they say, no, I feel this already.
You know, the disgusting part about these suckers is they get all they want to drink every time they drink. I have never gotten all I wanted. More than I could stand a lot of times, but not ever as much as I wanted.
But I don't feel a little tipsy and nauseous. I feel more settled and stable. I don't get sleepy and want to take a nap. I get adventuresome. I want to do something. Get out there. Do some things I hadn't done before. I don't feel out of control. I feel more in control. So instead of deciding not to drink anymore, I crave more. I can't see the craving. It's only felt. And that's physical, and it's not mental, and it's abnormal. And to find that out, I have to ask the normal drinker. And it's allergic. It's an abnormal reaction. I am allergic to alcohol. When the non-alcoholic begins to feel the effects of alcohol, they're ready to stop. When you and I, if you're alcoholic, begin to feel the effects of alcohol, we're ready to drink. And we're abnormal. We have an allergy. You know, Joe and Charlie tell us to see examples. We can see good examples very quickly. Joe and Charlie tell you about watching them on an airplane. If you fly on an airplane, watch them. Well, they buy a 1.5-ounce miniature. Pay what now for? Probably six, $7. What do they pay for now? I don't know. I haven't flown, because I haven't bought one in a long time. But they pay a lot of money for that, so it's terrible. And they'll pour it out into glass with some Coke, and they stir it with a stick. I don't know what that is, some sort of ceremony or something that they go through. And then they'll lay that stick down on a little napkin, and they pick up a magazine, and they'll read it. And you sit there and you say, drink that thing. And they'll read on and on. Sometimes the airplane is on final approach, and the flight attendant has to pick those things up so they can put the thing up, and they still haven't finished. I don't understand that. Charlie says he and Joe were watching a guy one time, and he made a mark halfway down the label pencil. He kept pouring it in until he got halfway down. He screwed the cap back on that little miniature, and he put it in his suit coat pocket. So on the way off the airplane, Charlie tapped him on the shoulder, and he said, I saw you measuring off that little bottle of alcohol before you made your drink, and he put the rest in your pocket. What are you going to do with that? Oh, the guy says, when I get home, I'm going to make me another drink.
Now, that may be normal, but that's sick.
I take my family to the beach, going to the beach the end of June, the 1st of July, 15th year. I take them down there, my kids. They like to do a little drinking when they're there. And so if you go to Sunset Beach, you ever gone to Sunset Beach in North Carolina, South Carolina line, you know you go by an ABC store just before you go across the drawbridge. So I stop in there. And again, one of them liters or whatever it is, 2-liter things now, you know, of cheap rum, because they like to make frozen daiquiris. And the first year I was down there, I was sitting in the living room back here, and they're making frozen daiquiris. Got the blender going, put the daiquiri stuff ring going, and they're reading directions from a book.
The recipe. They're doing the recipe.
They were making a double batch. And I heard one of them say to the other, how much rum do we put in here? And I listened. And here's what they said. 8 tablespoons. I came right up out of my seat. I ran to the kitchen. I wanted to see what they were doing out there. I mean, I spend good money for that stuff, bringing it in there, and you're screwing it up. And that's amazing. But you see the difference between the normal and the abnormal drinker. This is what we have to look at to explain the allergy, that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol, that most people don't have that reaction, and that makes me different. I've got to understand this. This is a theory that I have to understand if I'm going to recover from the disease of alcoholism. Who's reading? Me?
You, XXVI.
Okay, we're going
Roman numeral 16.
Going over, flip over one page where it says, we believe. Dr. Silkworth is writing again. You with me? It's XXVIII in the fourth edition if you have it. He says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average tempered drinker.
Okay, now Dick has already explained the word allergy. It is an abnormal reaction. We need to agree on the definition of terms if we're going to use them all through this little presentation. And let's look at the one in the sentence before. It says chronic, a chronic alcoholic. If anything is chronic, it is either continuing or happens over and over. It just means continuous. Okay, the word phenomenon is an occurrence that people see, and they can see it happening, and they can tell it's happening, and they really can't explain it, and they can't duplicate it. That is a phenomenon.
It says these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit, found that they cannot break it. Once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
So he gives a solution. He gives us a solution right here already to what the to cure the physical allergy. Don't drink. You know, that ain't no big deal.
Let's flip over one page to Roman numeral XVIII. That's 28 in the second and third editions, or XXX, I believe, if you have a fourth edition. 30. Top of the page, first. Second paragraph of the classification. Everybody with us? And what he's going to do here, he's going to outline some of the classifications of alcoholic, but he's going to explain what he just said about the allergy.
Okay, I want everybody to pay really close attention to this. And when this presentation's over, and you go home and you're in your own home and you're looking around, one day just pick this and read this up, because this is one of the most important chapters in this whole book. Because, you know, Dick went through when he did the table of contents. You understand that if you don't understand the problem, that's the first thing you've got to know. Because if you don't understand the problem, there is no solution. And the every 12-step program that I know of, all of the treatment centers, everything that is designed to help us alcoholics today is designed to help us recover from the condition described by Dr. Silkworth. And if we don't buy that as the problem, there is no answer. You know, because we're just as lost as we were. So we need to understand this and read it enough times till we become familiar with it and understand what he's saying. Here he's going to classify us.
Okay, he says, or Silkworth writes here on this page, the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. What he's saying here is that there may be 100 classifications, I don't know, but he says it's not important and it's outside the scope of this book. He says, I'm going to discuss 5 with you. Let's limit it to 5 because alcoholics, you probably can't handle more than 5 general descriptions. So let's point out 5. More outside the scope of the book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful, make many resolutions, but never a decision.
We call these type 1 alcoholics.
Then he says there's a type of man or woman who is unwilling to admit that he or she cannot take a drink. They plan various ways of drinking. They change their brand and their environment.
That's a type 2 alcoholic.
Then there's a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, they can take a drink without danger.
That's a type 3 alcoholic.
Then there's a manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by their friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written.
Okay, now that's a type 4 alcoholic. Now this next type is the one that Dick and I always felt like we fit into.
Then there are the types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect that alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people.
And I think that's most of them. And we'll probably find some of these types in all of us, some of the characteristics of all of these types. But alcoholics, I love what Dick says about us alcoholics, and we are. We are very capable people. What is that you say about them, Dick?
Wired for additional voltage.
There you go. Heavy-duty wiring. They get the job done.
I heard that early on. I still love it. Wired for additional voltage. I think you and I, if we're alcoholic, are that. But now watch what he does with these five classifications. He says it all in depth and more classification outside the scope of the book. Here's five. Now he brings them all home with one paragraph. He says all these and many others, which are outside the scope of this book, have one symptom in common, : they cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. It's never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. He wrote that in 1937 or 8. I think it still applies in 2004, don't you? You ever seen anybody who's permanently eradicated the physical allergy? Who's found a way to drink successfully? Now, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. What does that mean, folks?
Don't drink.
Great. That's pretty simple, isn't it? Don't drink. He says, and so this is one of the great first warnings of the book. Unless I unconditionally buy into this idea, then I haven't got a chance to recover. Because as long as I think there's a remote chance that I can drink successfully, I'm always going to try to find a way to drink. Once I unconditionally concede, 100%, that I cannot drink successfully, then I begin to try to find a way not to drink. So this is a vital turning point in this book and in the program of recovery.
Okay, so what he did is he divided us out into five different types. And then in that last paragraph, he lumped us all back in together. And what I hear him saying in that last paragraph is, you know, God forbid, if all of us would take a drink in here tonight, we would not all react in the same way. You know, we'd do different things. There'd be some that would be crying in the corner, boo-hoo-hoo, the world's not treating me right. There'd be a couple dancing on the table having the biggest time you've ever seen in your life. There'd be a couple back over in the corner putting the make on one another. We have a tendency to do that when we drink.
Two over here fighting.
But it doesn't make any difference what we do or the time frame on which we do it. The problem is that we would all need, want, and require more alcohol. Okay, that's the key. You want me to do the chart now?
Yeah. Exactly what
Stick
he said.
A little chart.
We're going to use a little chart here called the disease concept chart. It's the next handout that you have.
And you got this in your handout.
We want to be sure that you understand that this is not an AA chart. there are a lot of ideas about what happened. How come I am allergic to alcohol? How come I have a physical inability to handle alcohol without the phenomenon of craving setting in? Here is just one theory that kind of makes sense, and we use it here. Remind you again, this is not AA. Don't take this to your AA group and start to use it, because we don't. I've just made the disclaimer, okay? But let's look at part of this chart.
Okay.
And we're going to look at, Jerry's going to go through a part of the disease, the physical allergy that we've just been talking about. 50% of the illness, because of it, I can't drink.
And your body. Okay, you know, this is called the doctor's opinion. And it was written in the 1930s. But today we have so much, we have learned so much more about metabolism that the doctor's opinion has since been proven in fact. Because a lot of the stuff that I'm going to tell you tonight, I didn't learn out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't learn out of the big book. I learned in breathalyzer school when I was on the North Carolina State Highway Patrol.
Can you see him on the highway patrol? Can't you see him stopping and you're sitting in a Volkswagen Beetle? And he walks up to the driver's side window, 6'3", 280 pounds. You're looking right down his 357.
Yeah, buddy, all you can see is bone handle and belt buckle. You know you're in a world of hurt. But with the metabolism things that we have today, it's common knowledge among people that study this sort of thing, that a normal individual can metabolize 1 ounce of alcohol per hour. You can do this. And that's the norm. There are things that will make you more efficient or less efficient, depending on your size and the condition of your liver and pancreas and some other things. But a good norm to start with is the 1 ounce per hour deal. Okay. So if we decide we're going to have a drink, let's do what the normal people do over here. They are at ease with alcohol. They're not at disease. You take a drink, and it comes out over here. And you know, knowing metabolism, our body understands what we've done. It knows that we put a substance in there. And our pancreatic region and everything starts secreting enzymes in order to break this stuff down. And so what happens is, in these normal people, the first thing there is a series of enzymes who break alcohol down into a substance called acetaldehyde. Now, you've heard people, and especially women, tell their husbands, say, boy, old John got pickled yesterday. Well, this stuff is a cousin to formaldehyde. And, you know, they may be a little off base, but chemically they're right. You can get pickled on. Diacetic acid, another set of enzymes breaks it down into that, and that is kin to vinegar. So we're doing away with this altogether. Now, another set of enzymes breaks it down into a substance called acetone. Okay, that acetone, by more enzymes, is broken down into a simple carbohydrate, which is water, sugar, and carbon dioxide. Okay? The water we get rid of through the pores in our skin, through our elimination faculties. The sugar is stored as simple glucose. It's fuel for your car. Just like putting fuel in your car, you're putting energy in your body. Carbon dioxide we get rid of primarily through the respiratory organs, the lungs and everything is how we get rid of that. Okay, as long as these people don't ever drink more than 1 ounce of alcohol per hour, they can just go around and around that circle all day and nothing ever happens. But don't let them drink more than 1 ounce an hour. Because if they do, they either going to go to sleep on you or they may throw up on you. Because they do, like Dick said, they get sleepy and they get upset and they're out of control and they don't like it. Okay, as alcoholics, this is what happens to us. We take a drink, and the same identical thing happens as happens to the non-alcoholic. Gets over here, and those enzymes break it down into a substance called acetaldehyde. That acetaldehyde is broken down into another substance called diacetic acid. That's broken down into acetone. But here at the acetone level, we alcoholics have encountered a little problem. Because there doesn't seem to be enough enzymes, either in quality or quantity, to break this acetone down into this simple carbohydrate solution. So therefore, we take a drink and our acetone level increases in our body. Okay? Then we get to this feeling of craving that they're talking about, and that tells us to take another drink. So we take another drink, and we go around this circle again. It gets down to the acetone level. And now we have the acetone from the first drink, plus the acetone from the second drink.
You got two cravings now. It doubles up.
So it doubles works. Up, and it's and the craving's harder after the second drink than it is the first drink. You ever gone into a bar and say, I'm going to have one drink, and then I'm going home? And four drinks later, you wonder why you did that? Well, this helps explain this, because every time we take another drink and this acetone level elevates, it makes it that much harder to stop drinking. You know, I'm going to a bar at 6 o'clock at night. I can drink, and I can drink till closing time as hard as I can drink. I stagger out in the parking lot. Somebody runs over me with a car, and they say, oh, my Lord, can you help you? I said, yes, get me another drink. Because the craving is a lot harder at midnight than it was at 6 o'clock. And it's because the theory is that all of this craving is a result of this elevation of acetone. And that's a metabolic fact. We do not process alcohol like non-alcoholics.
Now, not only does this happen, I'm glad I know this, but not only does this happen to everybody, this physical allergy, and remember, it's physical, it's not mental. What Jerry just described, the allergic reaction to alcohol, the buildup at the acetone level, the crave, phenomenon of craving, this becomes even worse with age, because those two organs, which have a direct effect on the enzymes, which are of insufficient quality and quantity to begin with, begin to be less efficient because of the aging process. And I'm not suggesting just because I'm old, but the liver and pancreas got some age on them, and I'm convinced beyond a doubt that this applied to me the last day I had a drink, and that it would be faster and harder today, because the two organs that are vitally important in manufacturing the enzymes to break this thing down are less efficient today at my age than they were at that age. For those of you that wonder, less efficient at 73 than they were at 35, okay? I know that. So I'm glad I understand this. We see this, we talk about people who go out and have slips. And you ask them when they come back. I've been doing a survey for a long time, not many years. 14,006 days, okay? And I've been taking a survey of those people who go out and drink again. And I ask them a simple question. Was it better? And they always come up with the same answer. It was worse. It was worse. And I know why. Because this process of aging, as long as I thought there was, I'm glad I know this. This kind of shuts the door, as I said before, on my thinking that I can drink successfully when I understand this. It shuts the door. And as long as I thought there was a way that I could drink successfully, I was always going to try to find a way to drink. As soon as I understood that entire abstinence, which means don't drink, was a solution to this problem, then I had a chance because I would try to find a way to recover. Now, this is important information to know, but it's inconsequential if I don't drink. My real problem, we're going to hear about that a little later, that the real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. I understand that one of the important parts of this problem is the body, because I can't drink successfully. But the more important part of the problem is in my mind, because I can't quit successfully. The allergic part is of no consequence if I don't drink. Jerry's going to tell a fish story because this works.
Yeah, I've got a stepdaughter. God love her. She's a sweet girl and intelligent. I won't say smart, because I'm one of the few people who make a differentiation between intelligence and smart. I think intelligence is a capacity, and smart is an application. You know, you can have a 1,000-gallon tank and don't have a quart in it. It don't matter how big the tank is. And my actions, if I'm not doing the right thing, it doesn't matter how big my tank is. But this girl is a college graduate, and she is allergic, of all things, to shellfish. Now, she went through a period of about 4 or 5 years where periodically, every 6 to 9 or 10 months, she would tell herself that it was okay for her to eat shellfish. And she knew for a fact that she couldn't do that. She had all of these doctor's receipts, and she had all these trips to the emergency room, and she knew for a fact that she couldn't eat shellfish. But I could almost hear the wheels in her little head turning, you know, like, well, I haven't had any shellfish in 8 or 9 months. You know, and it might not be the shellfish either. I mean, if I would eat good lobster instead of shrimp, I may be okay. Or it might not even be the shellfish. It might be who I've been eating shellfish with. So I'll go over here and I'll eat shellfish somewhere else.
Or it might be where I've been eating them.
Yeah, absolutely. But the upshot of the whole deal was that she would periodically, for a period of 3 or 4 years, she would decide she's going to eat shellfish. She would wind up in the emergency room. Her throat would swell up. They would have to give her all of these anti-allergic things and get her an airway so she could breathe and all of this kind of stuff. Now, Jenny, was her problem the fact that she was allergic to shellfish?
No.
No. Her problem was that every once in a while, her mind would tell her a lie.
Okay to eat shellfish.
And she would go out and eat shellfish, and she would wind up in the same condition back in the emergency room one more time. That is exactly what happens to us alcoholics who do this thing over and over again. Okay?
We may be able to handle other problems and that aren't as important as this. Joe McQueenie tells a story about swimming. And if you know Joe, he's a black fella who didn't have a great deal of education, raised in the 20s. And he said where he was raised, nobody had any swimming pools. And he never learned to swim. Can't today. He say he can, but he goes to motels and around to these places where they were doing conventions and in the area he lives in now, and he can walk by. He can't swim, just like he can't drink alcohol. But he says he can walk by swimming pools all day long, and he never has a notion to jump in and see if he can swim. Two same problems. One he can't drink, one he can't swim. But he doesn't have any problem with the can't swimmer.
He said he'd probably swim just like he drank. Go straight to the bottom.
All right, let's flip back one page,
back
if you
one
will,
page.
To, again, back to Roman numeral XXVI, if you have a second and third edition, or XXVIII, 28, if you have a fourth edition.
Last paragraph on that page.
Yeah, everybody back there, we were reading up above, or we believe and so suggested, before we went over to classification. Now we're going to read down at the bottom of that page.
It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol.
Now, that's an issue with some folks, because some folks will say, well, I really love the taste of that, and I love the taste of cold beer on a hot day. We don't argue that. We don't argue the fact that some people like the taste of scotch, or they like this or that. We just want to make the point here, the big book does, that we drink essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. I love iced tea, but I've never gone into a place before it opened officially when the stools are still upside down on the table in the bar and the smell of pine oil is so bad, you know, you can't breathe, and ordered iced tea and still been there at 2 o'clock the next morning drinking iced tea. Never have done that. But as an example of that, to support this, how many of you remember the first time that alcohol helped you feel better? How many of you remember that? See? How many of you remember your first Coca-Cola? See, that's the difference. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol.
He said the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I love this sentence. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity.
Not drinking, feeling bad. Restless, irritable, discontent. I don't know any three words that better describe how, not drinking, I felt. Restless, irritable, and discontent. He's talking about the condition of the mind when I'm dry, just before I take that first drink, when I'm filled with shame, guilt, and remorse, restless, irritable, and discontent. And he goes on to say,
after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over unless this person can experience an entire psychic change. There is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules.
Now let's look at the other side of the disease, the mental obsession. Twofold illness, physical allergy, which we've already talked about. Now we're going to talk about the problem, main problem of the alcoholic being in the mind rather than the body. So we're going to talk about the other part of the disease concept chart. We're going to talk about this part over here. The problem. The emotional. Here I am down here. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm filled with guilt, shame, and remorse, and resentment, and self-pity, and fear. And I'm not feeling good. And all of us got this emotional barometer. And my desire is, I've already been told, that entire abstinence is a solution to my problem. So I know that I can't drink. But I got this daggum emotional barometer, folks. And this restlessness, irritability, and discontent, the guilt, remorse, and shame, and resentments, and anger filled that life brings on with its vicissitudes, as the non-conference-approved 24-hour day book called it, affect this emotional barometer. And I know that all I got to do is take one drink, and I'm in trouble. But I can't. I got to be careful of this because this emotional barometer is moving all the time because of these things here. This is my main problem. My emotional barometer can get up here, and I can throw up this willpower. We're going to see how this works because we're going to see a lot of examples in the big book about willpower and how well it works. Willpower works equally well on alcoholism and diarrhea.
With virtually the same results.
Same results. Okay, these feelings, these emotional feelings affect my emotional barometer. I throw off the barrier willpower, and I keep my barometer stays down here, and it's not necessary to drink, and something more. I become more restless and irritable and discontented. It gets up here, and all of a sudden it gets high enough so it gets on through that willpower. And I take that one drink. And here's what he's talking about here. Entire psychic change. He says, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than the body. If I can find a way to keep this emotional barometer down here, where I'm not so restless, not so irritable, not so discontented, not so filled with guilt, remorse, and resentment, if I can find a way to keep it down here, then it won't be necessary for me to take that drink. And if I don't take the drink, I don't have to worry about this other stuff. So the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than the body. How do I control this? He says right here that Jerry just read, follow a few simple rules. Wonder what they are. But the main problem of the alcoholic, the solution to alcoholism, is not in the knowledge that really that I can't use. I've got to buy into that 100%. This is where the program works, right here. Find a way to regulate this emotional barometer so that it's not necessary for me to take a drink.
By golly.
Okay,
that'll work. Now we're going to page one. You did the page one thing on Bill's story.
Yeah.
Now, what we've done here is we have gone over an in-depth study of what Dr. Silkworth had to say about the disease of alcoholism. And the reason, again, this reinforces the idea this is a textbook. Because if you were in medical school somewhere, and you were studying a disease, and they would teach you all they could teach you about that disease out of the book. And then they would probably put a stethoscope around your neck, give you a white jacket, and say, okay, Clyde, we're going out here, and I'm going to show you somebody that's got this. So Bill's story is exactly where it needs to be in this book, following the doctor's opinion. Because if we take the information that Dr. Silkworth gave us in the doctor's opinion, then we can see what that information does in an individual who has the disease. And you will see Bill recover. You'll see him get sick. You'll see him get sicker. You'll see him almost die. And then you'll see him come back. And you will see the progression of this disease in Bill. And please, for heaven's sakes, don't try to pick apart. Try to identify with Bill. If you can identify with Bill, don't find differences. Find similarities. Find places where you thought like he did. Or you find places where you felt like he felt. But we can certainly identify with Bill Wilson if we don't try not to.
Remember, an important thing about this textbook is that when they wrote it, they weren't considering the vast use that you and I make of it in our daily recovery lives or in our group or in a setting like this. They were trying to get the message. They were trying to get this message across to somebody who read the book for the first time. So they were trying to use Bill's story to do what is so important to us to do today, and that is our story. If we're doing 12-step work, our story in a 12-step setting becomes very, very important so that people can find themselves in our story and get hope. That happened to me on October 17, 1965, when two men in the living room of our house on that Sunday afternoon told us their story, and I found hope. I found two guys that thought, felt, acted like I did, drank like I did. One of them had been drinking 9 years and the other one in 5. And I was impressed. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker, incapable as I was that day of doing anything like that. So our stories, like Bill's story, is very, very important and continues to be very important. On page 1 of Bill's story, he says, war fever ran high in the New England town to which we new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us to their homes, making us feel heroic. There was love, applause, war, moments sublime, with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. In the midst of the excitement, I discovered alcohol. Now, we know that at this time, Bill was down in Rhode Island or Connecticut, and he was being entertained by people down there. He come out of Plattsburgh. He was a young officer in World War I. He was being entertained by local dignitaries, and he was enjoying it for the first time because his life had involved alcohol in his life up until now. And he says, amidst the excitement, I discovered alcohol. Now, I read this book and used it for years, and I didn't understand how important that was. Do you realize that non-alcoholics, normal drinkers, don't discover alcohol? They just kind of stumble across it. If you look up in the dictionary again, good place for doing it, if you look what discover means, it says arrive at through search and study. So most of us had a need for what alcohol did for us before we ever took a drink, and consequently, the reason we remember it and the reason it was so important to us, because we like the effect produced by it, because we discovered it.
Alcohol originally was a solution. It wasn't a problem.
I forgot the strong warnings and prejudice of my people concerning drink. In time, we went over there, sailed. I was lonely and again turned to alcohol. See, he's down here on the bottom of the chart. He's restless, irritable, and discontent. And how does he solve that problem? Turns to alcohol. Landed in England. Visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved. I wandered outside. And didn't talk much about his visit to Winchester Cathedral. Looks like he just went in, looked around. Here's a picture of it if you're interested up here later on. Pretty massive place. Pretty impressive place. Really is. Very impressive, as a matter of fact. Looks like he went in there, looked around, came out. He was much moved by the expansiveness of it, by the architecture, by that. No. If you look in page 60 of Pass It On, which is a biography of Bill, hope you've read a lot of that. Here's what expansion it says about that Winchester Cathedral encounter. It says an epidemic kept Bill and his regiment detained at a camp near Winchester. Depressed, lonely, and apprehensive about what lay ahead, going over the channel, Bill went to visit Winchester Cathedral. Amazing that he would do that. That he would seek out some sort of spiritual place. He said, inside the great cathedral, the atmosphere impressed itself so deeply upon him that he was taken by a sort of ecstasy, moved and stirred by a tremendous sense of presence. This is what he said, that's in quotes. He said, I've been in many cathedrals since and have never experienced anything like it. For a brief moment, he said, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. In that moment, Bill knew that everything was all right and as it should be. So there's an expansion on just how moved he was. And he wanders outside. Next paragraph down at the bottom of the page. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars. He comes back from World War I. I went home at last, fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation. That's all they got to do for an alcoholic. You know, give you a special token of appreciation, automatically figure yourself a leader. You know. Executive vice president of something immediately. My talent for leader. My talent for leadership, I imagined, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, and I would manage with the utmost assurance.
Okay, now, this chapter will also give us... Bill Wilson was exactly who God needed to found this thing, because we're going to see what he is. Bill Wilson is not an ordinary type individual. He is a high-powered, self-made man. I mean, he put himself through night school. He did all these things. Here, what is called in the employment ads today, a self-starter. So we can see just what a sort of a strong personality Bill Wilson really was. He said, I took a night law course and obtained employment as an investigator for a surety company. The drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important.
Already I can begin to identify with Bill as he thinks about this. I'd show the world that I was important.
That's right. He said, my work took me about Wall Street, and little by little I became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic that I was, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, it disturbed my wife.
Notice, now we're going to notice some other things about Bill that we can identify with, we hope, because we're looking for ways to identify with Bill here, even though he comes out of Ivy League colleges, raised in New England, was back in the 20s. But who's the first one that becomes disturbed because of his drinking?
His wife, the one closest to him.
Sure, the one closest to him. Who is the first ones that become disturbed about ours? Those who are closest to us, who touch our lives most important. Those are the ones who become, well, probably not much. Probably Lois didn't make a big deal out of it. She probably said, look, Bill, last night at the party, remember, I didn't see anybody else behaving like you did. Maybe drank one or two too many. Maybe ought to be careful in the future. Something like that. Disturbed her.
I can really identify with how he quailed her disturbances, though. He said, we had long talks when I would still her forebodings by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk. That the most majestic constructions of philosophic thought were so derived. Now, I can identify with Bill Wilson. I don't have a bit of trouble with that. He said, by the time I had completed the course, I knew the law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip.
The maelstrom is like a whirlpool or something that has the ability to suck you right in. That's what it is. He uses words here sometimes.
He said, business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge a weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. Living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into certain securities, then cheap and rather unpopular. I rightly imagined they would someday have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements. Now, you really need to understand what the condition of the economic condition in this country was at this time. This is when that boom in the 20s is just swelling, and all of these people have to do up here is invest money, and the stock goes up, and they take their profits, and they buy more stock, and it goes up, and all of this kind of stuff. And Bill had a sensible answer to this. He went to these people in these brokerage places, and he says, look, he said, we're just riding the swell of this market now. He says, what we really need to do is have information on these companies. Said, these companies need to be studied, and we need to find out what their management practices are, whether they are capitalized as they should be, how good their product is. We need to find out how good these individual companies are, and then we can direct our clients to invest not on just the strength of the market, but on the individual strength of these companies once we find out about it. And they told him, no, sir, we don't need all this. I mean, we're just enjoying this like it is. And Bill, like a good alcoholic, said, I'll do it anyhow. I don't need you.
I got this $1,000 that I made. Didn't he kept it, though. I'll tell you a little story about that.
He said, but my wife and I decided to go anyway. I had developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance of markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. We gave up our positions, and off we roared on a motorcycle. The sidecar filled with tents, blankets, a change of clothes, and three huge volumes of a financial reference service. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed.
Everybody know what a lunacy commission is? That's a group of people who decide whether you ought to be locked up in a mental institution or not. And that's what they decided about Bill and Lois. Now, these were young people, folks. This was in April of 1925 that they started this trip. Bill was 29 and a half years old, not yet 30 years old. And they roared off in a Harley-Davidson motorcycle with a sidecar. You don't ever see them anymore. And they got some blankets, a 7x7 wall tent, a change of clothes, and volumes of Moody's reference service. And they start out. They got $80 in their pocket.
Perhaps they were right. I had some success at speculation, so we had a little money. But we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our small capital.
In July of 1925, after starting in April with $80, they were down to $4. So they went to work in this farm in upstate New York. And Lois worked in the inside the house with the farmer's wife and a Polish family, and Bill worked out in the field. And they worked with this family for 5 weeks. And then the family paid them off, and they left. Paid them $93.25, and they started off again.
He said, we covered the whole eastern United States in a year. At the end of it, my reports to Wall Street procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. Now, you can see he's a self-made man. And Bill came back with this information, and these guys, these brokers said, yeah, now we understand what you were talking about. Said, we really need this. This is good, valuable information. And boy, Bill's just, he is just really enjoying this. He said, for the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived.
I can identify Bill Wilson. See, I reached points in my life when I thought I had arrived. This is the mental mindset of the alcoholic. I had arrived. I can identify Bill.
He said, my judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions.
I hope you'll underline that statement because we're going to look at another statement very shortly. But this is a literal explanation of how important Bill Wilson's information was and the information that he developed was to Wall Street brokers and their clients. And he said that his judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. That's stock certificates that they were investing in based on his judgment and ideas. He was that important.
He said the great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life.
Remember now that he started off by discovering alcohol. Now we see it notched up, ratcheted up a little bit. Can we identify with that? It takes a more important and exhilarating part in his life. Not out of control yet, but important and a kind of a stimulating part in his life.
He said, there was loud talk in the jazz places uptown. Everyone spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair weather friends.
Bill loves to drink, and he makes a host of fair weather friends. I can identify with Bill Wilson.
He said, this is a progressive disease. He said, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night.
Ratcheted up a little bit more, you see. More serious proportions, continuing nearly all day and almost every night.
The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf.
First it was Lois who was disturbed, and now his friends, those again, those a little bit distanced from him, but still close to him, tell him, Bill, we don't like to be around you when you're drinking because your behavior is unsociable and it don't make us uncomfortable. So what does he do? Typical alcoholic reaction. The heck with you.
I'll just drink
by
myself.
Who needs you? I'll drink by myself, and he becomes a lone wolf. See, I can identify Bill Wilson and see the people whose lives begin to deteriorate around him.
He said, there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. There had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife, helped at times by extreme drunkenness, kept me out of these scrapes. Now, I don't question nothing in this book, but I wonder about that.
Flip over one page to numeral 4, first paragraph.
Okay, now first paragraph. Abruptly in October 1929, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of the tape which bore the inscription XYZ32. It had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from the towers of high finance. That disgusted me. I wouldn't jump. I went back to the bar.
This is, again, a literal statement. Now, remember, you got to remember something, and I'm not going to go into a financial class here, but not only had XYZ gone from 52 to 32, but most of these people on Wall Street had what are called margin accounts with brokers. And a margin account will permit you to borrow up to a certain percentage of the value of your stocks at that particular time. And so most people were buying on margin at that time because everything was going up, and all of a sudden not only did the value of the stock go down, but they owed this money that they had used to purchase additional stock in the margin account. And it was a financial disaster. So what were the normal non-drinkers doing? They were literally jumping from the high floors of the finance building, committing suicide to their death. What's Bill's solution? I won't jump.
I'm going back to the bar.
I went back to the bar.
How many of us ever told ourselves basically the same thing? You get out of the hospital, you get out of jail, or out of the divorce court, or wherever it is you've been, and you say, I'm not going to do this. I'll just go back to the bar. Okay. He said,
my friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock, so what?
Yeah.
Tomorrow's another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Can you identify with Bill? He goes back to the bar, takes a few, and he says, this isn't so bad.
Yeah.
I was making too big a deal out of this.
You know, that's something that they say alcohol allows us alcoholics to do that normal people can't do. And that is, alcohol will allow us to change our whole perception of reality. And Bill just did this in the bar with 3 or 4 drinks. You know, this is not all that bad. You see somebody come home from work one day and they've repossessed his car, and he cries and whines and said, Lord, they can't do that to me. I can't get to work. I'm going to lose my house. They're going to repossess it. My wife's going to leave me. The whole 9 yards, you know, it's just terrible. And there's no way I can survive this way. And he can go in there and pour him about 3 fingers in a water glass, and you let that stuff settle down and catch hold. And he will say, they don't realize who they're messing with here. They can't do that to me. I'll take the tires off my car and put it up on blocks and tie my pit bull to the bumper. They're not going to do that. You know, but it allows us to change everything. Okay. Now.
Next morning.
Yeah, next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada.
Notice how Bill is real alcoholic. He bounces back. Yesterday he was down. Folks, as he knew, were jumping to their death. He goes back to the bar. The old fierce determination come back, calls this guy in Montreal. So I said, sure, come on up here, Bill. We're not affected by the crash. Look at what happened.
He said, by the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena for me. But drinking caught up with me again, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time, we stayed broke.
See what happens to him? He begins to drink again. He's got an allergy. He's got an allergic body, and he can't control it. And this good guy in Montreal fires him.
He said, I went to live with my wife's parents. We went to live with my wife's parents. That's what we alcoholics usually do. He said, I found a job, then lost it as a result of a brawl with a taxi driver.
Notice how his personal relationships have deteriorated now. He can't get along with a New York City taxi driver. And I'm going to tell you, if you can't get along with a New York City taxi driver, your social skills have reached a new low. First it was Lois, then his friends, and now he can't get in a brawl with a taxi driver.
You know, in the last 10 years, I haven't seen a New York City taxi driver that could speak enough English for me to even disagree with, much less have an argument. He said, mercifully, nobody could guess that I was to have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at brokerage places.
Just a little while ago now, I had you underline that statement that my judgment and ideas were followed by the many to the tune of paper millions. And now, just a short time later, he becomes an unwelcome hanger-on at the brokerage houses. They're telling him, Bill, we wish you wouldn't come in here. Bill, you don't look good. You got wrinkled suit. You smell of booze. You're drunk when you come in. We got customers coming in here. We wish you just wouldn't come in at all. Notice how things change for Bill.
And we're going to see an even bigger change in this next paragraph.
For those of you that are watching the clock, we're going to split the difference and be done a quarter of. We got a spot where we like to change off for tomorrow, okay?
He said,
liquor ceased to be
a luxury. It became a necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine.
Another important ratcheting up. You know, discovered alcohol, more important and exhilarating part. Now it ceases to be a luxury and becomes a necessity.
He's quit living to drink now, and he's starting to drink to live. He said, sometimes a small deal would net a few $100s and I would pay my bills at the bars and delicatessens.
Notice what he doesn't say. He pays the power bill at Con Edison, or he pays the rent, or he helps Lois with some of the debt in the house. What does he do? He catches up on his bills at the bars and delicatessens. Why does he do that? So he can drink on the cuff again when he isn't making any money. I mean, is that alcoholic or what? I identify Bill.
He said, this went on endlessly, and I began to waken very early in the morning, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin, followed by 6 bottles of beer, would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope.
We do that. We throw up that barrier of self-will, and there are little periods of sobriety which renew the hope of the people that are closest to us.
You know, you've heard the term going to hell in a handbasket. Well, everybody in the whole world right here understands and knows that Bill is going to hell in a handbasket, except one.
That's Bill.
He said, gradually, things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife and father-in-law became ill. Then I got a promising business opportunity.
Nobody's got any money. Watch this guy, how powerful he is, just who God needed. Nobody's got any money.
And he said, stocks were at a low point in 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. Then I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. Now, you understand, too, nobody had any money. Okay, Bill, it's no telling how much money he owes. He is an absolute fallen down, marginally dysfunctional drunk. And he has put together this group of people to buy stock. And he's convinced them. And they bought it. But Bill understood, they knew Bill. And one of the deals was, they told Bill, said, Bill, we're going to do this. We're going to buy this stock. And you're going to run this company, or you're going to do whatever you're going to do. But let me tell you one thing. We understand what kind of problems you've been having. And you cannot drink. And what Bill's reaction to that, Dick?
You needn't worry. I've learned my lesson.
Absolutely. He said that, and they believed him. And just before this deal was to consummate, they were sitting in a motel room or a hotel room in New Jersey, and they were passing around this bottle of Applejack. And Bill told him, said, "No, I don't care for any. I'm not drinking." And the bottle went around, and it came back, and the guy next to him handed the bottle to Bill and said, "Bill," he said, "man, you ought to try some of this." He said, "This is the greatest Applejack I've ever tasted." Says, "You know they call this stuff Jersey Lightning." And little wheels went turning in Bill's mind. He said, "You know, I've never had any Jersey Lightning."
One little drink of Jersey Lightning won't hurt me.
And he had the Jersey Lightning, and he blew the whole deal. Blew the whole stinking deal.
Went on a prodigious bender, and the chance vanished. I mean, this is a real alcoholic. Look what he said.
Yeah, he said, "I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did."
Now, he threw up that barrier of willpower. You notice he says here, this is the beginning of the end for Bill, because he says, "I woke up. I saw I could not take as much as one drink." That's that physical allergy part of the disease concept chart. The thing we were talking about over in entire abstinence. Bill understands now that he can't take as much as one drink. So you'd think he wouldn't drink anymore.
Okay, let's see how long that lasts. He said, "Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness."
Alcoholic enemies, folks.
He said, "I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone."
No other place had a telephone other than that cafe.
"In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did."
How many of us have said that? "I blew it. I've blown it now. Might as well get wiped out this time. Tomorrow will be another day." I mean, I can identify Bill Wilson. One more paragraph.
Okay. The mind and body, a paragraph.
The remorse. Okay. We're going to stop here.
Okay.
Because this is a good stopping point, and we'll start tomorrow on page 7, where Bill begins to really lose some more ground and begins to be in a position where he's dying and where things begin to happen of a positive nature. But I hope we can identify with Bill, and we can see what an important place his story is in the textbook sequence. Some of you may not have heard me during the break, but we have some circus jackets up here that'll fit your big book that are free if you'd like them. Let me tell you about them, though, that if you have a home group, and if you have a group in your own home church, and you carry your book in with one of these, it's hard to hide. I want us to close this meeting in the usual fashion, if you will. Stand and let's pray the Lord's Prayer. And the reason that we do that is because that seems to be a good way to close our meetings, and we'd like to do that again.
So this is what it looks like when you're on top.
Good-looking group of people. Thank you for coming. We want you to know that you're the most important people here, because with what little bit we can do, if you can carry this into the lives of others, that's what makes the big book study important. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Enjoy it.
I think we're on target. Thank you, Chris. I'm Dick Wright. I'm a real alcoholic.
Hey, Dick.
Glad you're all here this morning. Isn't it great to be somewhere and know where you were last night and who you were with and what time you got home and how you got home? It's great, isn't it? We're excited to be here with you, and we thank you for the response and the attention that you're showing for this big book study. We're on page 6, down at the bottom of page 6 in Bill's story. We've some things that brought us up to this last night. We see the deterioration in Bill's life as a result of his drinking. And the last event that we talk about is that when he got that promising business opportunity in 1932, when nobody had any money, and Bill, because of his very driven nature, puts a deal together, and they tell him when he gets this deal together that they'll work with him, but there's one condition: he can't drink. And he says, "You needn't worry. I've learned my lesson. I won't drink again. I won't drink." But you know, when they were the last day they were putting the deal together, that Applejack came around, and he took a drink of it, and he was off again, and the deal vanished. And here's what he says. He says, "I woke up. I saw I could not take as much as one drink." That's what we talked about in the physical allergy. That's what we've been talking about in the doctor's opinion as far as the physical allergy is concerned. He woke up. "I found I could not take as much as one drink." And so in defense, and to promote that, he throws up the barrier of willpower. And says, this time I meant business, and so I did. So he threw up the barrier of willpower. And this is not the last time we're going to see willpower used. But it usually works about as well every time we see it used. Didn't work very well for Bill, because the very next paragraph on page 5, he says, "Shortly afterward, I came home drunk." So willpower didn't last very long. And then he quit drinking a little bit, and he walked into a cafe to telephone. Amazing. The only place that's got a telephone is this gin mill. We alcoholics are cunning, baffling, and powerful. Bill's in a lot of trouble. He's drinking hard. He's mixing booze and sedatives. He's in bad shape. We see the deterioration of his relationships with Lois and his friends. He gets in a brawl with a taxi driver. All of these things are going sour for Bill. Bottom of page 6, last paragraph.
"Hi, everybody. I'm still Jerry Tomberlin, and I'm still an alcoholic."
Hey, Jerry.
He said, "The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years.
2 more years.
Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or the medicine cabinet, where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. There were flights from city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative."
Now, dual addiction. We have a lot of problem with that today, don't we? Sounds to me like Bill had a little trouble with it back then. Maybe we ought to be careful how much trouble we have with it today in AA.
He said, "This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity, so did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking, and I was 40 pounds underweight."
Now, Bill's literally dying here at this point. He's drinking himself to death. His life with alcohol and all the other things is literally taking his life, and he's dying. He's 40 pounds underweight. He says, "My brother-in-law is a physician. And through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics."
Now, Bill's brother-in-law was a doctor, and his name was Leonard Strong. He was married to Bill's sister. And he is a very important person in the early days of AA, and he was on the first, council?
He was a non-alcoholic member of the first board.
He was on the board of the first board. All right, this hospital that he talks about, the nationally known hospital, was Towns Hospital. in New York. And Charlie Towns owned Towns Hospital. And Charlie's claim to fame was he was one of the first people anywhere who had investigated the possibility of rehabilitating alcoholics. And he had convinced the people in business and industry that it was economically more sound to take these alcoholics and rehabilitate them through his hospital than it would be to fire them and hire and retrain other people. So he had a thriving business going on at Towns Hospital for alcoholic rehabilitation.
He says, under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain's cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much.
One thing about Charlie, he had a good PR department, but he didn't have much of a program. This belladonna treatment that he's talking about, belladonna is actually a derivative of a plant of the nightshade family, and it's poison. It will keep you from spasming. It's an antispasmodic to settle you down on the inside. There is still a derivative of this same plant that is used in hospitals today. It's called atropine. It's the same thing. So they would get you calmed down a little bit with this belladonna. Now this hydrotherapy, they took all your clothes off and they strapped you to this gurney, and they would go around through this big shower stall, and they had alternating cold and hot shower heads. And they would push you around through the hot water, and then would push you through the cold water, and then would push you through the hot water. And now I don't know what this did, but you got a nice clean drunk out of it. And the whole deal was they kind of settled you down a little bit with the belladonna. They cleaned you up on the outside with the hydrotherapy, and they cleaned you out on the inside because they did some other things. They gave you massive amounts of laxative, and you were pretty well clean when they got through with you with this deal.
Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though certainly selfish and foolish, I had been seriously ill bodily and mentally.
Now, this is in the summer of 1933. This is Bill's first admission to Towns Hospital.
His first encounter with Dr. Silkworth, who'd been there for 3 years studying alcoholics, when Silkworth told him that he was sick in two areas, as we've talked about a lot last night, physically and mentally. He says, it relieved me somewhat to learn that an alcoholic's will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. He says, my incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Remember, he said on the page over, I woke up. I saw I couldn't take as much as one drink. And he was desperate to stop. Yet he couldn't. So now he says, my incredible behavior back when he stepped into the bar and took that first drink again, in the face of a desperate desire to stop, was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge.
Now, if you would like to underline that, there is going to be a trend in this book. We are going to see several people that try this, knowledge and self-knowledge. And let's just see if we can get an accumulative deal of how well this works with people.
So with Bill, we've seen willpower thrown up. It didn't work very well. Ha, maybe now, knowledge and self-knowledge, after he comes out of Towns Hospital and Charlie gives him all this, Dr. Silkworth gives him all this information, maybe this will work for him. Let's see. Now he's got it. But it was not.
Oh, my Lord. He didn't last a whole
sentence. Didn't last very long, did it? For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining moral and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital.
Now, this is in the summer of 1934. This is Bill's second admission to town.
This was the finish, the curtain, it seemed to me. My weary and despairing wife was informed that it would all end with heart failure or DTs, and I would develop a wet brain perhaps within a year. She would soon have to give me over to the undertaker or the asylum. In the summer of 1934, during his second hospitalization, he overheard Dr. Silkworth talking to Lois. And he didn't like what he heard because Silkworth told Lois, this seems to be a hopeless case, your husband, Bill, this great guy.
And I don't see any other recourse for you than to begin to make plans to put him away permanently in some asylum or mental institution, or to bury him, because one of these two things is going to surely occur. He says they didn't have to tell me. I knew and almost welcomed the idea. Life was so bad that I almost welcomed the idea of one of these two things: being locked up from society where life wasn't so bad, or dying. Didn't sound like bad alternatives. It was a devastating blow to my pride. I, who had thought so well of myself and my abilities and my capacity to surmount obstacles, was cornered at last. Now I was to plunge into the dark, joining that endless procession of sots who had gone on before. I thought of my poor wife. There had been much happiness after all. But what would I not give to make amends? But that was over now.
Now, you know, if we would find ourselves in the shape now that Bill Wilson finds himself in then, we would go to AA. I mean, you know, somebody would tell us about it, and we would go and we would begin the process of our recovery. But there was no place then for Bill to go. There was nothing out there. Nobody had recovered from alcoholism during this time. And the steps hadn't been written. There was nothing. Bill had no clue what happened. Okay? But in this next paragraph, I want you to just make a little check by this paragraph, because it is one of the plainest, most concise descriptions of what's later going to become step one in our program that I've ever seen written down anywhere.
See if Bill, in his mind, while he's in the hospital, doesn't consider the provision of powerlessness of step one when he says this: "No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity, that bog, that swamp of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. Not only was I in this bog, this swamp, this morass, but I couldn't get out of it because there was quicksand all around it." He said, "I'd met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master."
Now, he has come to a full understanding of the powerlessness of his condition right here. He has accepted in his mind the concept that's later going to become our step one.
Now remember that, because this is firmly imprinted in Bill's mind. He's going to use this a little later. It won't come into writing for a while, but he's got it in his mind, the idea of powerlessness and unmanageability. Great explanation in this paragraph. "Trembling, I stepped from the hospital." This is during his second admission, from his second admission in 1934. "A broken man. Fear sobered me a bit. Then came the insidious insanity of that first drink. And on Armistice Day 1934, I was off again."
Now, back then, they celebrated holidays on the actual day. They didn't do them and move them around to Monday or Friday to give people long weekends. Armistice Day was always on November the 11th, whatever day that had to be. And on November the 11th, Bill started drinking again.
"Everyone became resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere," that's what Silkworth had told Lois, "or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. In reality, that was the beginning of my last debauch. I was soon to be catapulted in what I would like to call the fourth dimension of existence."
Now, if you'll make a little check by that, because Bill refers to this later on, and we're going to find out what this fourth dimension of existence is later on in this presentation.
Kind of a foreign term to us over here early, but we're going to find out later on in this big book study what that fourth dimension of existence is. He says, "I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes." Now, here he is. He'd been drinking since November 11th. Got to understand the way Bill drank. He wasn't a marginal alcoholic. He wasn't a borderline case. He's drinking hard 24 hours a day. Imagine the shape that he's in at this particular juncture. "Near the end of that bleak November, I was sitting in my kitchen. Been drunk for about 2 or 3 weeks. Sitting in his kitchen. With certain satisfaction, I reflected there was enough gin concealed about the house to carry me through that night and the next day. My wife was at work. I wondered whether I dared hide a full bottle of gin near the head of our bed. I would need it before daylight.
My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. Now, we know that this is Ebby Thatcher. We've talked about Ebby before, the old school friend of Bill. Bill knew him. Bill knew him to be a real alcoholic. Bill knew that Ebby Thatcher was a real alcoholic. Ebby didn't have to present himself and tell his story for Bill to say, wow, this guy had a drinking problem just like me. Bill knew that he did.